Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. Today on Spark My Muse, I have a returning guest, Eric Zimmer, the host of the One You Feed podcast. Eric encourages us to feed our good wolf, and his podcast has been featured as a top podcast on iTunes in 2014. He has featured some of the greatest luminaries and teachers in our time. I've always really been encouraged by the work he produces, and I'm so grateful to have him on my show today. I wanted to catch back up with you a little bit about what you're up to. And I listened to I watched your TEDx talk, and I thought that would be a great way to catch people up on what you're doing for all the new listeners that I have who haven't heard your podcast. But it was such a great, I loved your TED talk, and I thought it was so usable stuff, that the stuff about behavior change that you talk about quite a bit. And the common thing that people do where they think, I really need more willpower, I really need more discipline, and not realizing what you say is that behavior change is a skill. And I think that's such a powerful point. And I thought maybe we could discuss some of your points in the TEDx talk. You did a TEDx talk for Columbus, and I'll put this in a link in the show notes, of course, to your website and everything. And people can, I hope, watch the whole thing, because it's a really good one. And I was wondering if you could go over a little bit of that. You use the game of risk as an example, and maybe you could talk a little bit about how you kind of came to this conclusion. And of course, you've spoken to all these 150 guests over these 3 years, and you've read a lot and accumulated all this wisdom for yourself. But so you can just talk about doing your TEDx. Were you nervous, or you don't look too nervous? How did you do it? Were you afraid?
Well, it's funny that it's a pretty big TEDx. I think there was 900 people in the audience or something, and they ran two a morning and an afternoon session. And so I wasn't really nervous until the day before, and I went to do they have us do a trial run. So you come in and you stand on the stage and you do your thing, and I felt like I bombed. Now, everybody was like, oh, you're fine. But I knew it was like half as good as I could do. I mean, this isn't right. So I just sat there the rest of the day in the dressing rooms there and just worked on it. I got myself into a weird spot where I originally was going to memorize the entire thing word for word, which I never really do that sort of thing. But there was a lot of recommendations from even people who've given, really famous people who've given big TED Talks, who said, yeah, oh yeah, I knew every word. And I thought, okay, well, if somebody who's that good is going to do that, I will do the same thing. But I didn't quite get to the point where I could do it. So I was sort of stuck in between, like almost being able to do it word for word, but having to think about it too much. So I finally then went, okay, I got to give that up. Like, I just need to go out and just talk through the stuff I know. Like, I know this stuff very well. I just need to kind of go out and do it. And so I was a little nervous, but the minute I got out there, I was kind of okay. And then it was great because I got to do it again that afternoon. So I did it that morning, and then I got to go back out in the afternoon and do it again, which was nice to have sort of a repeat chance that quickly.
You know, you have a lot of things on your podcast about behavior change and lasting change and things like that. But also you have on all sorts of other things about improvement and self-improvement and things like that, and all kinds of different wisdom. What made you decide to do something about changing behavior?
Well, most of the coaching work I've done has been around changing behavior. I mean, I do coaching with for people for some other stuff also, but that's really the focus. And I would say it's the area that I feel most comfortable with. I mean, I was, I'm a recovering alcoholic and addict, so that's pretty big behavior change. I've worked with hundreds of people that are trying to recover. And so, you know, I just feel like I know that space pretty well. And I really do think that we all have a tendency to really blame ourselves when we're not good at it and say, well, like, I just, you know, I can't do this, or I always start things and then I quit, or, you know, I'm the kind of person that doesn't have willpower. And I think that that's, there's so much to be learned in that space. I find it a particularly interesting place. And I think the other thing too is a lot of the things that I'm interested in, the other things that we talk about, you know, I've got meditation and a spiritual practice and becoming aware and all that. But the thing is, all that stuff is predicated on the ability to sort of say, here's what I'm going to do, and then follow through on it. So I was thinking about this the other day. I was like, I've read so many meditation books that tell you how to meditate, but nobody tells you how to build a meditation practice habit, right? Because that's the hard part. At least it was for me. And the hard part for me was to go, okay, I want to meditate, and to do it every day consistently. I'd start, I'd stop. And so I think it's a lot of what the show talks about, and all these great things that I think we can do in our lives to make our lives better. Really, you do have to have that basic skill of being able to manage your behavior, of what you're going to do and not do. And so I look at it as almost like a step one for everything else that we talk about.
That's so true. You can also get addicted to just information and not put any of it into practice. I know that just even listening to podcasts or going to conferences or reading the books or something like that, you can accumulate and just not take that step. You're looking for the motivation. Like, one of the things you say in your TED talk is so good. We can be trying to amp ourselves up and get the motivation to do the action. And you're saying sometimes motivation follows the action, and you just have to start first, and then you get excited and motivated, and it can work either way. But sometimes we don't take that first step. We're waiting. We're thinking, okay, maybe if I go to this next conference, or I hear this next podcast, or I get the next tool, and that action doesn't happen, or it doesn't keep happening. And I think those are the places we can fall down, and we'll think, I'm not disciplined enough, or I don't have the willpower. And it's that thinking of behavior change as just a skill that you're working on, that you're adjusting along the way, it is a really helpful kind of mind frame change that can help you not get so discouraged, I guess.
Well, yeah. And I think that if changing your behavior and doing good behavior, you know, if exercising and eating right and meditating and all that stuff was easy, you know, our world would look very different.
Right? Yeah.
It's not easy. It's very hard. And it's hard also because our lives are so full and we're so busy. And so these things aren't easy to do. And so I think we have a tendency to try it and then fail and then feel bad about ourselves and give up for a while and then eventually get disgusted enough where we're like, all right, I'm going to do it again. And we start out and we do well, and then it fades off again, and we're like, I just can't do any of this stuff. And it's sort of this, I know just a lot of people who are in that loop sort of perpetually. You know, I know for myself, like you're talking about, like gathering information. If I had meditated over the last 20 years as often as I read about meditating, you know, I would be, you know, I would have a lot more meditation time. I don't really know what the result of that would have been, but I would have had a lot more. It was really only in the last 3 years that I got to the point where I was able to make it a daily habit. Before that, it was on a month, off for 3 months, on for a few weeks, you know, just very sporadic. I mean, I've been doing it a long time, but I never got a whole lot of consistency. I think over the years, the time sort of adds up, but I've done more meditation in the last 3 years, probably time-wise, than I probably did in the 15 years before that, I mean, maybe not, but you get the idea.
Yeah. And meditation is one of those things that a lot of people are like, oh, you know, I really wish I could meditate more. That and one of the things I've been doing for February, trying really concentrating on, is staying off of social media, which I have to, you have to remind me to ask you a question about this. I don't want to forget, but I'm going to ask you about some of your discipline on social media, not getting caught in the fray, I guess you could say. But one of the things
the
I'm
last
doing
days for, have not been good for me.
It's so hard. So meditation is something that, you know, a lot of people will say they know it would really help them, or they want to develop a practice, and they feel like a total failure if they start thinking thoughts, right? If they can't, you know, really turn their brain off and things like that, and they'll give it up really quickly, kind of like you're saying, you know, start and stop. And one of your things in your TED Talk, talk about the game of risk and taking the small continents first, you know, in terms of like applying that to meditation, it could just be that you, I think it was you that was talking about sound meditation and listening to sounds and just trying that for 2 minutes and not worrying about the thoughts at all in your head, but just for 2 minutes, try to listen to all the sounds around you or something like that. And not feeling like a failure if it doesn't work out, just taking that little tiny chunk and considering it a success, and just building on that, and not thinking, okay, I didn't meditate for 20 minutes like I wished I could have, but you know, counting those successes when people talk about a minimum effective dose, I think it's Tim Ferriss is one of the people who talks about that. And there was a guy talking about interval training too, and the fascinating studies about interval training for, I think it was like three minutes of incredibly intense training 3 times a week with a 5 minute warm up and cool down versus people who are consistently walking for 3 50 minute sessions a week got the exact same exercise benefits. And it was this minimum effective dose was incredibly powerful, just as powerful as, you know, 3 minutes versus 150 minutes. It was, and so that really can make you these huge strides by doing some minimal stuff. And
yeah, and I don't know what the minimum effective dose for meditation is, right? But I do know that 2 minutes of meditation is more than most of us do. Right. We have this tendency. That was where I always got tripped up with meditation, is I would do it for a little while and then I would quit. And then eventually I would find my way back to reading about it. And they would talk about, you know, oh, you should meditate for 30 minutes every day. So I would start off trying to meditate for 30 minutes every day, which is really hard. It was really hard for me. I think some people settle into meditation pretty easy. There's a certain group of people who, when they meditate, it feels good to them. I am not of that category by nature, right? I am very distracted. I'm very restless. It's hard for me to sit there. My brain doesn't really shut down very easily. I go between either my brain is very busy or I am asleep. You know, those are my two normal meditation states. So I would try and do it for 20 minutes. And the problem with trying to do something for a large amount of time, there's a couple of different reasons why starting very small is very effective. One is because our lives are, you know, there's this idea of equilibrium, right? Where like our lot, you know, everything sort of regresses back to the mean or kind of to what it was, right? And so when we make a bunch of changes in our lives, we really throw things out of equilibrium. And the very nature is that things sort of work their way back to where they were. Whereas if you start small and build, you're very slowly sort of, there's not this big change and then a reaction and then a big change and a reaction. It's a much more gradual process. The other thing that I think is really important with meditation is There's something out there. We had him on the show. His name is BJ Fogg. He's a researcher at Stanford about habit creation. And he's one of the, you know, he's probably one of the best out there. And he's got something called the Fogg Behavioral Model. And it's really worth looking into. But it basically says that a behavior occurs when both motivation and ability are at the right level. So motivation is how much you want to do it, et cetera. We all know what that is. Ability is a little bit trickier. So ability on one hand could be like, do you know how to do it? But in the case of meditation, I would say that ability is how much you're able to sit there and sort of get through what it can be a challenging and difficult process. So if you're trying to do something that takes a lot of ability, you have to have a lot of motivation. It would be like running. If I want to run, go out and run for 10 miles every day, I have to have an awful lot of motivation if I'm not really a runner, right? I have to have a tremendous amount of motivation. And motivation goes up and it goes down and it goes up and it goes down. On the other hand, if I want to take a walk around the block for 10 minutes, the amount of motivation I need to do that is much less. And so if we believe that as we do certain things, our motivation might increase, and as we do things, our ability increases. So I walk around the block every day for 10 minutes. I'm able to get that done. And as I'm doing that, I'm becoming more motivated and I'm becoming more able to exercise, so that soon doing 15 minutes feels pretty easy and doing 20 minutes. But when we try and push ourselves to something that's really difficult to do, we have to keep an incredibly high level of motivation, and that can be challenging to do. So that's why the slow, gradual building works so much better. And I think this is a place that all of us get it wrong if we don't think about it. We almost always start too big. And we gut it out for a little bit of time because we start motivated. But as the motivation fails, as the motivation starts to shrink, it's too much. Whereas the more gradual building really makes such a big difference.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. And the other thing that starting off even ridiculously small, as you were saying a little bit there, it also will short circuit fear, because that's what gets us to procrastinate, is like we're worried about a big change, and so we'll just push it off just a little bit because we're actually really just afraid. And I know with I started back in November because there was one of those franchise gyms that opened up nearby, and I thought, oh, that's good, I'm gonna join. But I don't know if I'm going to go enough that it's worth it. So if I just show up at the gym, that's a win. I don't have to stay like a long time. I just have to get there. And if I walk like 5 minutes on the treadmill, or, you know, 5 minutes on the elliptical or whatever, then that's frosting. That's extra. If I just get there, that's a win. And because I thought of it like that, I didn't worry about anything else. And I don't know. It's a real weird little trick. I mean, it's so silly, but it made a huge difference for me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm always tricking myself into doing things. I mean, you would think I exercise, you know, pretty regularly. I mean, I have for years, but there are still plenty of days where for whatever reason, there is resistance. Like there's just a lot of resistance. And I almost always, you know, get past resistance by tricking myself into all you got, like you said, all you got to do is go to the gym, or all you got to do is get in your car. I mean, about the only time anything gets cleaned around my house is when I say, okay, I'm going to work for 3 minutes, and I set the timer. And then I usually finish whatever it is that has to get finished. But getting started is really difficult. And so it can be very effective to do exactly like you said. You sort of trick yourself into starting by giving yourself permission to do a very small amount. We do procrastinate things that are ambiguous and things that are overwhelming. And sometimes whatever the thing we're doing feels overwhelming, even if all it is going to the gym and, you know, lifting weights like you've done 30 times before. There's a lot that can feel overwhelming if you're very, very tired. The other thing that can be a challenge that gets in the way also is how many steps are between you and doing that thing. You know, so like for me, I don't know why, but changing my clothes to get into my gym clothes is a big, I don't like to do it, or I just don't. It's one of those really silly things. But once I can get through that, I'm usually okay. But that's why knowing, you know, habit wise, where you're going to do something and when you're going to do it and what you're going to do is so very helpful. Because if you have to figure all three of those things out as well as motivate yourself to do it, boy, that's an uphill battle. Right. But if you know right where, when you're going to do it, you know where you're going to do it, and you know what you're going to do, you've eliminated. Now you don't have to figure that out. All you have to do is follow the plan that you have. And so that's one of the things I talk with my coaching clients about all the time. When and where, you know, there's lots of studies that show if you decide when and where you're going to do something, your odds of doing it go up dramatically.
Mm. Right. And accounting for the failure points, like if you know the clothes are the problem, have three sets of gym clothes already in a bag, already in your car, you know, like yep. you're already know, all right, these are ready to go. I know. And if one of them's dirty, I have another clean one and I'll just take it into the gym, quick change. But it's weird though, that we'll psych ourselves out over something like that, which will probably take maybe 90 or 100 seconds to change our clothes. Oh, but it really will be like, ugh, not that. I don't want to do that. I'm tired.
Yeah, that's one of those human quirks that just cracks me up because I have that completely. Like the difference between how often I will practice guitar if my guitar is sitting on a stand versus sitting in a case. And it literally takes 30 seconds to open a case, pull the guitar out and play. I feel like an idiot even saying that, like, oh, well, I do it more when it's out, because how could that be a problem? But it just works better. I mean, when I try and do mini episodes from time to time, and I don't do them with nearly the consistency I'd like, but the difference between whether my audio equipment is already set up or not makes such a big deal. Like if I'm traveling and I've got it in the suitcase and I've got to get it out and then set it up and then do the mini episode, it's so much harder. And setting it up is 5 minutes at the most. But that stuff does matter. And so that's the sort of thing when people are talking about habits and behavior change, they start talking about the environment, your environment. And your environment is everything around you. And if we can work to make our environment more conducive to what we're doing, we just make that stuff a lot easier. And so your point about the gym clothes, or the obvious example is if you want to eat well, don't have crappy food in the house. But all that little stuff really does make a huge difference. And so if you do get your environment tuned as best you can to support the changes you want to make, and I include in the environment the people that are around you or the people that support you or having accountability, you know, one of the things I talk about in the TED Talk is that, you know, people who have a number of people who are supporting them are, you know, at least 50% more likely to make a behavior change. And that doesn't mean that you have to have like a cheering section. It just means that if you've got some people that know what you're trying to accomplish and are generally supportive, you're much more likely to be successful. So that's another one that most of us miss. Most people are trying to change their habits and behaviors by themselves. And, you know, if you look and you see people who are successful, there's a group of women I see run down my block all the time, and they've been doing it for a long time. And I think a lot of the reason why they're there on an incredibly regular basis is that they're doing it together. And so, you know, they don't want to disappoint the other person, or they, you know, it just makes such a big difference. But we all in this culture, we tend to just embark on these projects by ourselves. It works so much better when you do it with other people. And, you know, it's what I talk about that in the TED Talk a little bit, and some of my own experiences with that.
Yeah, that is so true. We're such social creatures. And my husband's in a cycling club. They meet, you know, on Tuesdays or Thursdays. And you can have a really rough day at work, or it can be a little chilly out, and you'll give yourself, you know, 50 excuses to not go. But if you know that the guys are going to show up and be looking for you, you'll go. Or if you're doing a project, a writing project or some creative project, and you have some kind of group or some people know that, you know, a critique group or just people kind of checking in, you don't really want to let them down or let yourself down. And it's a whole different thing if someone else is kind of, you've circled them into your group. It really, I guess it's just part of how our brain circuitry has worked to be socially connected, whether it's dieting or sobriety or a project. It is so crucial. And you're right, when we are going solo, it's almost like we turn on ourselves and we create, I don't even know, like the self-talk almost takes the place of the other social connections, and you can wind up beating yourself up almost instead of having other people that bounce those ideas and take the place of those other conversations.
Yeah, I mean, I think the coaching work that I do with people, I mean, I certainly think I give people, you know, tips and techniques and teach them how to do some of this stuff. But a lot of it, honestly, is that there's somebody that they feel accountable to. And I ask them to send me an email every, you know, we touch base via email every day. And there's just something about having that touch base with another human who cares what you're doing that causes people to be much more regular in doing it. And, you know, so sometimes I think that's, you know, 50% of the value I provide is just I'm there kind of checking in, and they're checking in with me, and they know they need to send an email each day, and they don't want to go to bed and, you know, not have done their thing. You know, it makes a big difference. And so you can hire somebody like me to do that, which is fine. And, you know, I'm certainly always happy to do that. But you can also build those things into your own life with, like you said, with friends or with other groups, or just finding a way to do it.
Hmm. Yeah. Now, when I went to your website, it said that you aren't taking any more coaching. Is that true? Or are any spots still open?
Right now, it's no spots are open. However, you know, I always encourage people just send me an email, and you know, when I open it up again next, I will get people in. So I've tended to sort of do, you know, sort of enrollment windows where I open it up and, you know, take in a good number of clients, and then work with those people for a while, and then open up another window. So I've just found that better than sort of perpetually keeping it open, and mainly because I'll have a tendency to take on more than I can do otherwise.
Right. Now, are you going to scale at all? Are you going to do a webinar or any kind of bigger thing with a bigger audience?
Well, I'm in the midst of our first group coaching program.
Okay.
And so it's a different thing. Mm-hmm. So the jury's out on whether I'll continue to do it or not. This one's going pretty well. It's a small group. So I think part of the question is how big could the group be that would make it worth it? I am working on what I would say, I wouldn't call it coaching, but more education. So I'm presenting a couple workshops here in Columbus for a couple organizations about a lot of the stuff around habit change. So I'll probably do, you know, some sort of online course or a webinar where I teach people how to do it. But the coaching to me is much more of an individual, like we're working through your things more specifically. So I think that can only get to a certain size group before you lose that. But yeah, I definitely am looking at ways to scale getting the information out there to more people without me having to be involved in everyone. But I do love the working with people individually. Mm. I still really enjoy it and am able to do it. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard. You can easily get stretched really thin when you want to invest, but you can only go so far.
Yep.
With people. But so I'll go back, I'll revisit the question about social media. So I've been personally pulling back and trying to not be part of so much noise, but there's a lot of, as you well know, on Twitter is a lot of outrage and it's a lot, yep, a lot of craziness, and I get sucked right in just like everybody else. And I haven't noticed, I follow you a lot, and I haven't noticed. You usually put out nice wisdom and maturity and everything. And yeah. I was wondering, how do you stay composed, and how do you keep putting out good stuff when not get sucked right into all that?
Well, it's interesting because I've been wrestling with this a lot. Obviously, you know, there are very strong political views in the country right now, and there's an awful lot of rancor going on. And so I have been wrestling with, honestly, like, okay, what do I do with the platform that I have? You know, I have opinions on these things and I care about these things. And I think probably a good part of my audience, you know, shares the same views. Although I did a post-election episode, and I certainly heard from some people who didn't. And I mean, I was very mild. I mean, I was basically like, look, all I want to say is that, you know, like, do what you can in the world that you're in, you know, stay focused on the positive that you can do, and don't assume that everybody who thinks differently than you is an awful person. And I even got, you know, I got some flack from that. So I've thought about, like, okay, what's the right thing to do? You know, should I be using this platform, so to speak? I mean, I've got a decent number of people who are following and pay attention, and should I be using that to engage in these political debates? And where I've landed for right now is that in my personal life, I will do, you know, I'll do the things that I think are important to do. I'll make the phone calls, I'll do donations, I'll do all the stuff that I think is important. But as bad as what I think some of the people are doing politically, I think just as bad is the divide that we're drawing up between ourselves. And so I feel like, based on where I'm at and what I do and what my show is about and all that, I don't want to engage at that same level. So when I engage, I'm trying to engage on a can we listen to each other type level. Or, you know, I'm trying to engage with the sort of spirit that, you know, Martin Luther King engages. And again, I'm not trying to make a comparison between me and Martin Luther King. So just everybody take a deep breath. But I look to someone like that as an inspiration for how, you know, hate can't drive out hate. You know, I believe that to be true. And I see so much of that happening. So that what I've just decided to do, what I want to do with The One You Feed, is that I want to put out messages that I believe are more timeless, right? So they're still relevant a week from now, 2 years from now, 10 years from now. They work in all situations, a slightly different view than the moment-to-moment political view. So again, in my own life, I will engage in that stuff and do that stuff, although I find it largely completely counterproductive. I think that we just, you know, I put out something and mainly to people who believe the same thing I do, and we all get outraged and say the same things, and it doesn't really do anybody any good. Or we insult somebody else. And, you know, the thing that bothers me the most right now is that I see both the left and the right picking out the worst examples of the other side as a stand-in for the whole side. So if you're conservative and you love Trump, you look at the people who are looting at a protest, you know, or the few people who are violent, and you go, that's what liberals are. They're these things, you know. And if you are liberal, you pull out, you know, David Duke from the Klan as the stand-in for everybody that believes in that stuff. And I think that's terribly destructive, because 90% of the people on either side are nowhere near those extremes. But it's those extremes that we use as our justification for why the other side is wrong. And as long as we all keep doing that, there's no way to come together. And believe me, I feel the temptation. You know, everything that the other party does that I see, you know, it can be fuel for the new outrage. And again, I do believe that you know, it's important to speak up and speak out, but I just don't want to use this platform, the One You Feed platform, for that type of thing. I think there's a broader and a bigger game there. Now, that could change at any point. I mean, something could start happening, you know, we could start locking up Jewish people, right? And all of a sudden I might feel really different about, like, okay, hang on a second. Like, I have to speak. But and I don't know that I have the right answer, but that's kind of where I'm at right now in the way I've been thinking about it.
Right.
Which I've been thinking about it a lot, actually.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know. It's hard for me to know. I mean, everybody has an angle, and there are people who profit from outrage. And so directly profit from outrage on every side of the issue. And so then you're like, well, everybody has an angle and everybody has something to profit from making sure people are outraged on whichever side. And so to me, there's a lot of propaganda and it's suspect. And so you have to do a ton of research to get to the bottom of it. And you will wind up confirming your bias, whatever your bias is. You won't check into the thing that confirms your bias. You'll check into the thing that you're like, oh, that figures. You won't check into that one. You know, you'll be like, I knew it. And you won't say, wait a minute, is that true? And really, really research it. You'll just maybe retweet it, you know. So I've been trying to back off that because I don't feel like that's if it spreads like wildfire and no one's willing to spend an hour or two, including me, I am not willing to spend an hour or two to really research it. And really, journalism can't keep up with it because the tail is wagging the dog on that. It's really hard to it's really hard to come out with any kind of statement on something. But
It's a difficult time. I mean, it really is.
It really is.
And although I may be pretty good at holding my tongue, I have over the last, you know, 4 or 5 days, it's like I can't turn away. Like I am spending way more time than I want to looking at Twitter in particular. And so I'm sort of figuring out, like, okay, I need to come up with a plan here because I mean, you asked me very early on, I don't even know if it was part of this interview or before, but like, how do I keep up with the workload that I have? And the answer is I don't spend it on things like a lot of social media. So this last few days is not sustainable in my case if I want to continue to, to do the work that I do.
Right.
And so, and it's, it's not like I enjoy it. It's not like but it's like a train wreck. I'm having a hard time looking away from it.
I'm totally tracking with you, Eric, because you want to stay informed, but at the same time, you're like, how informed do I have to be? Like, I'm not sure I want to know the basics, of course, but like, you don't know how much is necessary to know. And then how much is like, I got to get back to my work because I know I have to make the stuff, like you're saying, the evergreen stuff, like in 5 years, it's going to still matter that people improve their lives. But some of the things that are in the news right now that are really, really hot topics are not even going to matter next week.
Yep.
And others could really matter. So you're not sure.
Yep. Well, I mean, I have a general policy that I try and follow, and I don't do it perfectly, which is largely not to spend a whole lot of time or energy on something that I'm not going to do anything about, you know? And so that's why if I'm going to engage, it's like, I want to engage and, you know, what am I actually going to do? So, okay, I feel a certain way. All right, I will call my senator and express my view. I will donate to the organizations that I think are important. If there's a protest that I think is useful, I will go to the protest. But beyond that, just stewing in it doesn't really do any good for me or anybody else. And I do think that if this is ever really going to get better, there has to be some sort of healing between the left and the right in this country. And it'll never be. I mean, this is a perennial age-old problem, right? I mean, it feels worse to us than ever it's been. And maybe it is in some ways. But this is a pretty, you know, not a new thing. But I do think that I get frustrated because I think that the middle, you know, 60% of the country more or less could agree on an awful lot of things. You know, maybe it's even 70% of us. If we could talk to each other, I think we could agree on a lot. But it's the far fringes that make all the racket and make all the noise and drive all the agendas, and it frustrates me. And so I try and stay out of playing that either way and see, to what extent can we have conversation with each other that's useful and brings us together. But again, that's just how I'm feeling about it now. But it is a tough time. No
it
doubt.
Is. And the volume is cranked up to 11. Oh. And, you know, when it's maybe been on 8 or 9 in the past and it's felt really difficult, now it's super cranked and it's hard to know what to do. Like I kind of, you know, it's almost like, is there any way somebody can just take out Twitter for like 2 months, just kind of like from an inside job or something. But for people who are trying to make good things in the world, trying to make add some wisdom or add some thoughtfulness or try to improve people's lives and do our part, I think you're doing that. I'm trying in some little way to do that, and we're hoping that the crazy, you know, hurricane or whatever is happening here a little bit dies down, and it doesn't seem like it's going to happen soon, but that people kind of regain their composure somewhat, that we work on the tough stuff, but that we can come to our senses at some point, and that some of the things we do will be evergreen, and that people can return to them, and people can hopefully use the arts to express themselves and have dialogue and conversations and work, I hope, in as locally as possible, instead of like screaming across the bow in national ways and just in like national protests, but like actually work in communities with people who need help and things like that, work very locally to solve problems.
Yep.
That's kind of my hope. But to do that, you have to be ready to get messy, and you have to be mature. You can't just be ready for a fight. So it really is hard work that you're right. If you're not willing to do something about it, you can't spend a lot of time and energy thinking and worrying and tweeting, because it's not really going to do anything.
Yep. Well, you can, and lots of people do.
True.
But it's not necessarily advisable.
Yeah. Well, maybe I'd like to shift gears a little bit as we kind of round out our conversation here. And I have been curious as to what were some of the biggest gems that you got in the past year over with some of the people you've talked to as guests that maybe made the biggest difference in your thinking or some of your own growth.
That is a great question. And I have a hard time necessarily always remembering a lot of the specific moments. I think the takeaway, probably the big takeaway for me over the last year, and maybe a little bit longer, but it just continues to become more profound, is the importance of our external world also. I think I had a view of spirituality that was very much informed by the Buddhist tradition, and specifically the meditative Buddhist tradition. And so I had this idea that happiness, you know, we all say it, happiness is an inside job. And I believe that there's a lot of truth in that, and that most of the culture and most of us err towards, you know, focusing everything on the outside and ignoring the internal. But I think the thing that I've really gotten from talking to guests over and over and exploring different things is how important the connections with people in our lives are, and how having good social connection, how that improves our health so dramatically, and how when we don't have that, what it does to our health. I mean, the studies are kind of alarming about, you know, isolation and loneliness and what that does to us, you know, physically, emotionally, mentally. So I think that's been a big takeaway for me in general, which has said, okay, it's not just an inside job, it's both. And so that's helped modify my thinking in general. And so I've sort of looked towards guests to a certain extent that help, you know, that might bring that sort of wisdom to the fore. And then I think the other thing that I've been exploring more, and I've always sort of, it's just weird because I feel like the show sometimes is, I'm not quite sure. Like, on one hand, I'm very focused on a very practical, like, you know, here's behavior change, here's these things you can do. And yet I have this definite pull towards a deeper mysticism and a transcendentalism. Mm-hmm. And trying to see how those things fit together is an interesting, sort of, I won't say conundrum, but it's something I think about. But the show seems to me to kind of, I feel like it, I don't feel like it changes a lot. And I can't decide if that's good or bad. Because I think that I've had these sort of core interests that I wanted to explore, you know, through the show all along. And they're really about what's emerged for me besides the needing the external, and this is actually a variation on that, is really thinking about the middle way and how much it's the extremes to one side or the other that get us into trouble with so many things. We were just talking about it politically, right? I was just talking about it from, if you only focus on your internal, if you think all the growth is internal, you're missing the outside. It's kind of, it's both. Yeah. If we look at our character traits, right? Any of them can go from being, you can have too little of something or too much of it. So let's take courage, right? Or, you know, bravery. If you have too much, you become reckless. If you have too little, you're meek and scared. The right place to be is somewhere in the middle. And I think that is emerging for me as the thing I'm kind of very much interested in. Where are all the places that concept applies? And it applies in so many places. You know, I was thinking about, you know, the middle way in relationships. Where do we get in trouble in relationships? It's usually when we start talking with our partner about always and never. You always do this, you never do that. That's not true, right? Do they do things that we don't like? Yes. Do they, you know, but where's the middle ground there? How do you step aside from the extremes? And this just seems to apply in so many disciplines of life. You know, I talk a lot on the show. I ask people, you know, help me understand how you see dealing with an emotion, because the extremes are I repress the emotion and I simply don't allow myself to feel it. Or the other extreme is I sort of let my emotions run my life. You know, I do whatever my brain tells me to do, whatever emotion happens, that's what I'm doing. And so where, you know, how do you find the middle ground between those two? Because both those things, neither of those things are healthy. And so that's probably the takeaway that, you know, I'm kind of coming out of 16 and really interested in going into, you know, 2017. It's the, you know, the serenity prayer is, and we were just talking about, you know, only focusing on things that you can change, you know, the, you know, courage to change the things we can, the serenity to accept the things we can't change, and the wisdom to know the difference. And that's kind of walking down that middle line. you know, we find, you know, as you start talking with people about doing lots of things, there seems to be like you can try too hard at things or you can try not hard enough. And again, what's the middle? So that's, I think the middle way is my current biggest interest. And I think it's just talking to lots of people that help that evolve for me.
Yeah. And do you think you were more of a person who's been more expressive or more like suppressive of your emotions, or just kind of one way or the other? It's always been one extreme or the other.
Well, I mean, I was an addict for a long right. time. And so, you know, addiction is sort of the, I mean, it's almost being, you know, following your emotion to the point that you circle back around and become repressive,
yeah,
right?
Right.
It's like everything, I feel bad, so I go and do this drug, and then that makes me feel worse, and I go and do the drug. Mm. And so I'm letting my emotions lead me around by the tail, but basically what I'm doing is suppressing them. So it's weird amalgam of both those things. I don't even know if I said that word right. Or is it amalgam? I don't know. I there's words that like I never hear said, but I read, right. and that's one of them.
Well, yeah, you're kind of, it's kind of medicating. You're kind of medicating because you're not sure where that middle is. And so, you know, you're trying to figure it out. I don't know if you've had any Jesuits on your show, but the Ignatian spirituality has a really interesting mix of how contemplative spirituality meets an active life that's lived out in the world. And you probably know that Pope Francis is I'm not Catholic, by the way, but Pope Francis is a Jesuit. And so he's mm-hmm. active in the world and, you know, he'll still sneak out in the middle of the night and feed the poor and things like that. They don't like him to do that or anything, but, it's a big security risk, but because that's how his spirituality is, it's incarnated. It's like, has to have hands and feet, but then the contemplative side of it is very much where you get your energy from. It's that meditative side. And that's been very attractive to me personally. And I don't have any plans to become Catholic or anything, but there's something of that mix like you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I love it too. It's got the meditative mystical side that doesn't put the divine in a box or anything, but also it has that lived out practical side that has a realness to it and an embodiedness to it that makes sense in the world.
Yeah, and that's again sort of a middle ground, mm-hmm. right? Between, I'm an activist or I'm a contemplative. Well, where, you know, how do you sit in the middle? We had Matthew Fox on, who I believe is, I think he was a Jesuit mm-hmm. and got kicked out, but, it's a different story, but yeah, I mean, that's another of those great examples. And to sort of tie it back to where we started with behavior change, a lot of us have a tendency to either we work out, like we said before, I do an hour every day or I do nothing. You know, it's like, if I can't do it perfect, I just don't do it. That's a big one. And so being able to say, all right, well, there's a middle ground between not doing something and doing it a huge amount. And that middle ground is to start small and build. And so, again, I just kind of that's tying this all the way back to the beginning of the conversation. Mm.
Very good. Well, that's the perfect place to put a bow in this, right?
I think so.
Thank you so much, Eric. This has been really wonderful. And I wish you all the best as you continue with your show and with all your other projects. Do you have anything else coming up that we should make listeners aware of?
Let's see. Well, we do have a Facebook group now. Which is, you know, I think we're creeping our way up to 1,000 people in the group. And it's just a really nice, it's not the final answer to being isolated or lonely or any of that, but I'm finding it's a place that people can connect and, you know, share things that that are important and we have in common. Mm-hmm. So I certainly encourage people to check that out. We will be opening the coaching program up again. And as the year goes on, we'll be releasing some sort of online courses. So just one you feed. And then the thing, you know, I remain most proud of is just the show itself. So, you know, it's at oneyoufeed.net.
Oneyoufeed.net. And the Facebook, is it just facebook.com/oneyoufeed?
If you go to Facebook and search for the One You Feed discussion group.
Okay, good.
And then you just ask for to join and come on in. It's really, yeah, it's really, it's evolving, and I'm happy with the direction it's taking. I'm marginally involved, but it's really, you know, I really want it to be for the other, you know, the people. I don't want it to be something that like I'm driving, so.
It's kind of an open source. People can kind of just get together and share, and it doesn't have to be directed or anything.
Right. Yep. That's exactly what it is. And it's, I'm really happy with how it's, we've got great, you know, great listeners. So, you know, the people that are listening and are really into it are every one of them I've met. I've just always been like, wow. Like,
you know. Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Eric.
Yep. Thank you.
Listen to the show and you've thought, wow, I wish I could find out a little bit more about someone mentioned or a book or a website. That's what show notes are for. I've created an all access pass, and you can access the access pass for just $1. It unlocks all show note episodes too. It's a reoccurring $1 a month, and you can cancel at any time. Just go to patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Patreon is like patron with an E. patreon.com/sparkmymuse. Remember to subscribe to the show on iTunes or your podcast app, and I invite you to sign up for my newsletter at sparkmymuse.com. I try to send out a message once or twice a month. If you enjoyed the show, please rate it on iTunes. Thank you so much for listening.